Hey, you're listening to 2ARM FM, Armidale Community Radio. It's a little after 10:22, and I'm delighted that we're starting the interviews, the regular, I think, fortnightly interviews with the Mayor of Armidale Regional Council, Mr. Sam Copeland, and Sam's in the studio with me. Good morning, Sam.
Morning, Paul.
How are you?
I'm well. I'm enjoying the cooler weather.
Yes, although I think the last few days and this week are going to be just that touch warmer, I'm hoping anyway. I've just come back from many years in the Northern Territory back to Armidale, and I was pretty good before I left with the cold, but I'm struggling at present, I can tell you. What's been going on in council? I thought I'd start by talking to you about the run-up to the council elections, and at that time you and I think fair to say there was a loose group spoke about money, budget, and a more business-like approach to running Armidale Council. And we know that, being polite, that that hasn't always been the case, or put it like that. And you did focus, or a group of people that specifically focused on the skills, the skill sets that they brought to council, and you were one of them. We're about halfway through the term. How would you rate yourself and the council's performance against the ideas that were discussed and promoted prior to the election?
I think we've been very true to what we said. The way that we've gone about it has probably been a little bit different to how it's anticipated. The way that council is run and the role of councillors probably isn't very widely understood in the broader community. People, I think, confuse that our role as councillors is to be in the operations. So that's, not necessarily driving the grader or emptying the bins, but there is a sense that we are there reviewing development applications, where they're looking over the budget, where they're making decisions on hiring and firing, that sort of thing. That's not the case. It probably hasn't been the case since the late 80s. So the role of councillors is we're effectively, if you think in corporate sense, we're effectively a board, and my role as mayor, I am the chairman of the board. Now, it's never, council isn't a business.
And it's not really framed in that way.
And it's not really framed in that way, but we're a quasi-business, we're a quasi-service, we're a quasi-everything. But the role of councillors is to set strategic direction and give an overview of what we want the what we want the region to look like, and direction as to how we're going to get there. So, in terms of setting goals in February, so we were sworn in on the 12th.
Just before you go to that, can I just clarify? And I think the point you're making is that professional councils these days have a manager or a CEO, and that they take care of the operational side, and council, as you say, take care of policy, direction, and act somewhat like a board, and the CEO is responsible
to
the board.
That's right.
In a corporate sense.
So as councillors, we only have one employee, and that's the general manager,
yes,
or CEO.
Indeed.
And I think we're very fortunate with the general manager that we have at the moment, and the executive team that he's built underneath him, and then also the next level down as well. So and that's about as far as our visibility goes.
So going back to the question, in terms of policy and direction and strategic ideas, how do you rate yourself in the council?
I'm going to give us 10 out of 10 for that.
I knew you would.
Yeah. But not necessarily for egotistical reasons. I mean, although, I'll tilt my hat to that. I think what this council has done, and it's, and I'll credit my fellow new councillors for it, is we've been prepared to make tougher decisions and, we've been prepared to make the tough decision, not the soft decisions. And so, and I'm sure we'll get to this, that's in terms of the special rate variation. We've decided we genuinely have two options, and this region has been at a crossroad. We either shrink and wither on the vine, which we've been slowly doing. So the growth in this region has, we're flatlined for 25 years. Population hasn't increased. Production, so the gross regional product hasn't increased. We are unique in that we just haven't done anything.
And was COVID a big hit in that regard as well?
And COVID caused a bit of a dip, but not so much for us. So if you think about what we produce education, tomatoes, wool and beef.
And there's a fair amount of motels around Armidale, so there's obviously...
There would have been a dip.
An accommodation industry.
Yeah, that's true. Although I'd say that our tourism as such is nowhere near what it could be.
I have to absolutely agree with you. I think traditionally and for all the time since I first came to Armidale in the early 2000s, tourism has been handled very poorly.
Yep. So, look, we decided as a council, we could have said, all right, we need to manage this decline. That's the trajectory that we've been on. We just need to take control of that and just continue the decline and, you know, try and touch the plane down gently on the water.
So you're rating yourself well. So let's go to a few.
Yeah, sure. some of the specifics.
A few substantive issues, and we should start around income and expenditure, I think, because you've touched on that. Council has officially requested a rate rise from the New South Wales government of 50% over the next 3 years, and that is the special rate variation you mentioned. You will be aware that this has created some consternation and resistance amongst ratepayers, particularly at this time because of the increased cost of living expenses, mortgage, you know, a lot of people coming off fixed mortgages, that sort of thing. And they're looking at it from their personal point of view as how am I going to pay for this? How are we going to fit this into the family budget? You're looking at council's budgets and thinking, how are we going to meet all our obligations? These two don't always align, do they? The needs of ratepayers and the needs of council. So if you speak to that issue, what do you say to ratepayers already struggling, particularly those with young families or maybe coming off fixed mortgages? How do you explain it and even justify it to them?
I guess there's a couple of reasons. I'll give you a generic one, then a few specific answers here as well. So this is something we had to do, not something we wanted to do. So there is a recurrent shortfall in asset maintenance of $7.5 million per annum. So every council has balanced their budgets by not spending money. And this is you know, one thing I've had...
And that's what households do.
Is what households do. And I've had people put that to me in the public meetings. And if I were to credit councillors again, this is something that we actually stood up and went to public meetings that this we need to do this. Other councils have hidden behind and just wheeled out the staff to do that. But people have said to me, look, you know, live within your means, that's what we all have to do. Now, I'd be economically drier than anyone in a room. So I understand that more than anything. And in a business sense, yeah, sure, live within your means. So if something is underperforming, you either sell it off or you shut it down. So our biggest asset, in inverted commas, is our road network. So we have $1.1 billion of assets, which a significant part of that is our road network. So if we were to live within our means, as people say, sure, tell me which 600 kilometres of dirt roads we shut. That is what living within your means looks like if you operate as a business. So if I'm economically dry and when I get that put to me, that's what the end result looks like. Now, council isn't a business, as I said before. It's quasi-business, quasi-social. We provide social services. We provide services that, you know, you otherwise wouldn't receive because there is no upside in doing it.
And can I say, I do agree with you. It frustrates me when I hear politicians at the two levels above you, and we've heard it a lot over the last few years at federal level. We run the country like you run your family business. A government is not a business. No. But maybe we can help people with this. Let's have a look at, or could you have a look at, what income streams does Armidale Regional Council have? So there's the money coming in, and you've talked about the going out and the maintenance of assets, maintenance of roads. What are your income streams?
The only self-generated income we have are rates, fees and charges. That's it. Whereas if you're a city council, more than 60% of their revenue is own source income, being rates, fees, charges, things such as parking stations, et cetera, et cetera.
Even parking tickets.
Parking tickets, $28 million per annum in parking tickets in the Waverley Council. Mm. So we don't have any of that own source revenue yet. And this is a yet because I reckon we can get it. And you know, this could be a subject of another day. So there's that, which is about 30% of our revenue comes from rates. Then there's some grants that come in, the federal assistance grants. So there are some tied grants that must be spent on certain things, and there are untied grants that we have a call over. So we're largely at the whim of state government and, to a lesser extent, federal government. But to circle back to your initial question, which was how do you explain to ratepayers what do we do? Mm-hmm. No one really wants to do that. And I think if we didn't do this rate adjustment, special rate variation, rate rise, call it what you will, it speaks volumes as to the sort of as to the character of our region, because it is the least fortunate in our society that will be impacted the most, because a larger proportion of their life is council services. So the well-off, the council services aren't a big part of what they do.
And those people have the poorer vehicles or...
They have the poorer everything. It speaks volumes as to the sort of people. Are we greedy, miserly, self-interested people? Or are we open-minded, good-natured, broad-hearted people? Now, there is a very... And I said before, I'm economically dry. I'm starting to sound like a bleeding heart lefty here, which those who know me will probably suggest I'm not. We also need to look at what does it really mean. Percentages and dollar terms are, you know, a percentage can sound terrible. I had one woman, she came in to see me and she had said this rate rise, she'd written it down, she'd called it a travesty of justice. And I thought that was a bit harsh. And I said to her, what does this actually mean for you? Travesty of justice. Tell me, how much more will you pay? She said, I have no idea. I said, but that doesn't sound right. If you've said something's a travesty of justice, surely you've gone the next step to work it out. Bearing in mind, she's also a pensioner, so she gets a significant discount as well. I can only speak for myself. So I know that my rates, so it's on the base rate, it's not everything else. So my rates, I live just on the fringe of town. My rates are $900 per annum. If this rate adjustment comes through, it means next year I'll pay $150 more, the year after that $300 more, the year after that $450 more. I think that's a fairly small price to pay for a region that hums. And there's also a lot of misinformation out there. So I and my fellow councillors, we are lucky in that we have the information. In an information vacuum, people just make stuff up.
So I actually was going to go to communication later, yeah. But I'll make another point, and I'm trying to remember who made the quote, but there's a really good quote, and I won't be accurate, of course, but it's the one that says that one of the measures of a society is the way it treats or looks after the least fortunate in that society, and that's... I think that's the other side of the economic dry position, isn't it?
Oh, of course, and that's the point I was trying to make before.
Yeah. So, okay, so you want this 50%, when I say you, I mean council, want this 50% increase, and that's your application over the next 3 years. Now we're at a point where the emergency service levy is going to take what percentage of that away, do you think?
The increase in that would be $300,000. So the previous state government had said, look, there'll be no further increase. The state government will wear further increases in the emergency service levy. The new state government's come in and they set what those increases are going to be. And we have to pay for it. So in terms of what it would mean in the first year, roughly 10%. Just goes that hadn't been budgeted for, so that's a little bit harsh. And this is something that I've really, you know, those that have been on council for a while are familiar with it. But the cost shifting of state and federal governments is phenomenal.
Think health. think education.
Think health, think education, think childcare, think everything. State governments used to run childcare. They gave a lot of childcare to local councils and said, we'll fund it. And after 2 years, they pulled the funding. Mm-hmm. So now it's up to the council to say, either wear that cost or pull it. So these sorts of things happen fairly regularly. It's cheap. Council provides over 30% of all services in a society and controls over 40% of the assets, but its actual capacity to raise revenue is 3% relative to the federal government's 85%, relative to the state government's about 14-ish%. It's...
Go on.
Nuts. It's absolutely nuts.
So how do you... Do you have to reframe the budget at the next AGM?
Yeah, we will have to. We will have to reframe the budget. There will be bits that, just can't happen. I might just maybe to draw, tie a bit of a bow around the whole rates thing and the expenses. We were meant to have found out by now whether we were successful with our application.
Through IPART?
Through IPART, the ironically named IPART, because part of the delay is they said we had to wait for the new government to come in. So maybe it should be a small IPART. Anyway, that's an aside.
So wrapping it up.
Wrapping it up. We were one of 23 councils seeking a rate increase. I know in our... And so in our region, Tenterfield went for 80%. We've Glen Innes nothing. We've gone for 50%. Euralla's nothing. I'm just working down the line. Euralla nothing, Walker's gone for 50%, Tamworth nothing. I would venture that next year those councils that didn't go for anything this year will go for similar rate rises. It's just the nature. Local government is set up to fail unless you're actually brave to make decisions.
And I'll make the point in passing that one of the reasons for shifting responsibility is not only financial, as you pointed out, but more and more I think governments are recognising that when you shift responsibility, you also shift risk.
Oh, of course.
And that's
plenty of joy.
That's the other side of that, yeah. Isn't it? Some people, including some very experienced long-term members of your council, are concerned or have expressed concern about how councillors communicating matters like the emergency service level, the special rate variation with ratepayers. And I was going to put to you, what would happen if we could, say, try and change the current council ratepayer paradigm to one where we recognise a mutually beneficial relationship between both groups? Because I think that's underlying it, but I don't think that's really the paradigm that's in place. And I wonder if you would get less flack if you shifted to that sort of paradigm, to that sort of approach.
Possibly, but
being a bit philosophical,
very philosophical, that would require a changes on both sides. Mm. I think council's historically been a very easy whipping boy. It's easy to
well, that's because of the top down approach, and it's easy to hit up, isn't it? But if you saw a relationship of mutual respect,
yeah.
Benefit and responsibility, what would happen? Is it possible?
Look, I think everything theoretically is possible, but you come back to this absence of or the information differential or vacuum where, we know what is probably going to be a good thing. We've tried. I think certainly with the rate variation, we tried to, and I think we're reasonably successful in getting that information out there and talking extensively about it. In terms of people being unhappy, well, that's always going to be the case. I think you have to be realistic. What surprised me is we only received, I think it was around 300-odd submissions against the rate increase across a population of 30,000 people. That's pretty minimal. 15% of those were supportive. So all up, it was... I was actually surprised by how little negative feedback we received.
Talking about communication, you're right. Talking about communication, it was interesting to see, and for those that don't know, the LGNSW are the peak body, in a sense, for councils and handle all of these things. They've been using some pretty alarmist language in their press releases and in their communications, words like catastrophic, stratospheric. Do you think this helps? Do you think that, my experience is when you start speaking in that way, you often get the other parties back up. And if they're the peak body for councils and they're, in a sense, carrying the arguments around the rate rise and the special service levy increase, if they're carrying that on behalf of councils, is it useful? And you probably don't want to criticise them, but again, we're talking about communication.
It's probably not. I'd say that sort of language really was in relation to the emergency service levy, because the rate rises are very council specific. I think a bit of loud language is okay as long as that's not your only channel. And knowing the people at LGNSW, they're not monkeys. They will have had another
back channel, perhaps.
They will have had some back channels. They will have had, other, more sane and sensible communication. But I take your point. It's never good to open the batting just by yelling at people.
And for those that don't know, this acronym stands for Local Government New South Wales. And yes. As I said, they're the peak body for councils. There's something that's been, moving right away from that, there's something, an issue that's been in the news a lot lately, and that is the PwC, PricewaterhouseCoopers, conflict of interest matter.
Yes,
and this is very much around the fact that they are, on one hand, working with government and assisting government and contracting to government. On the other hand, they were using information generated from that work to assist their clients. And so conflict of interest is never going to be as big for a council, but I thought I'd ask you, does council have any potential conflict of interest matters in this area under review at the moment with your the people who bring work to you? And I know that may be more a question for the CEO, but at a policy level, I think you'd see what's happening.
Yeah, it's certainly a very interesting question, and that PwC thing has been in the news, and quite rightly too. It'll be, when I was in the 90s, I used to work at Ernst & Young, now EY, which is one of the big four consulting firms. And back then, there was the big six and big seven, and Arthur Anderson, that actually had the best brand, imploded as a result of the Enron debacle. So that was in the early 90s. Now, that, because all of that originated in the US, it trickled throughout the world, and that collapsed the brand. But I think PwC probably has the best brand of those big four consulting firms, and this will make it very, very difficult for them in Australia. So to bring this back to a to council, to Armidale, I am not aware that we would have any potential conflicts of interest with any of our consultants. Now, we do use consultants for specialist skill sets, a bit like anyone uses a contractor.
Engineering and others.
Engineering and planning. So the things that the skill sets that are hard to get, hard to attract and keep people on staff, or there's a specialist, you have a specialist need for a short period of time.
And if you're an organisation, like a business, you can have a couple of independent board members appointed to bring in those specialist skills, but council doesn't have that option.
No.
As we talked about earlier. So my next question then is going to be, given that that's out there, and I think a lot of organisations are quickly checking their records and their books, I'm told, at the moment. I have a dear friend who worked at the Millionaire Factory, and quote, you're talking back going a few years ago to the big companies, and he and I, and this was part of his area, we've talked about this at length. Do council actually have any policy around the use of consultants, and what mitigation policies are in place to prevent conflicts of interest? Because what I see is that in quite a number of organisations, the major mitigating policy is to give them a piece of paper and say, sign here that you don't have any conflict of interest. And there's actually not any checking. It's self-reporting only. And self-reporting is part of what's got PwC into trouble. Do we need to be more proactive, I guess, or does council need to be more proactive?
I think council's pretty solid at the moment. We do have a risk management framework in place for any appointments over a certain dollar amount, and I can't recall off the top of my head what that is. We put things out to tender, so request for tender for particular skill sets. So that would come in. Then they're assessed on a criteria, price, ability to deliver, local input, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then it goes before council to make decisions on it. So I think there's a fairly thorough vetting of a lot of things. And one of these was kind of related, but it's not as specific around a role. We had lawyers up to go on a panel for codes of conduct. Much of the closed session of council meetings really is awarding tenders and contracts for things that are commercial in confidence, and only the winner, if you like, is announced.
But my concern, I guess, is that I think what we're seeing is that self-reporting, no, we have no conflict of interest, sign on the line and dated, is perhaps no longer enough, or in terms of risk management terms, perhaps there does need to be a little more than just relying on self-reporting.
I think so. I'll take that one on notice. Maybe I can come back with more specifics about what we have in place.
Another issue which got a little heated in council is the issue of a sign recognising traditional owners at the major roadways into Armidale, possibly at the airport as well and at the bus station. There were two motions. The first one was only supported by one councillor, Brad Widders. The other than you, I think, moved and or seconded the second one, and that one has got up, but it doesn't have any time frame attached to it. Can you give a little background to what is going on here? Because I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, there's something that's bubbling along under here. I'm not quite sure what it is.
There is nothing nefarious going on, despite what some people might think.
But there is politics.
Not really. There's not politics to the extent that people think there's politics. We, as a region, we probably stand out in that we don't have any acknowledgement of the traditional owners or the lands on which we sit when you enter our LGA. And Councillor Widders put something up.
And that is not controversial in this day and age, is it, to have that?
No, and nothing about that I think is controversial at all. And I'd say that there is, and we should be, only because I think some somewhat clumsy commentators are trying to make a name for themselves to allude, to allude that there's, you know, inherent racism and paternalism in council. Nothing could be further from the truth. The councillors. The second motion that got up, and that was a foreshadowed motion that I had in my back pocket in the event that Councillor Widders' motion didn't get up, because I wanted to maintain the momentum. So I think Council, in putting this up, Armidale Region is a bit unique, because we don't sit on the lands of just one group, and some of it is quite hotly contested. And so council laws, in terms of putting some signs up, need to actually hear from all sides. We shouldn't just have a single source of truth. And so this was about hearing from all sides to try and come up with some wording that might be appropriate. Now, it will probably mean that we'll come up with something fairly generic, But so be it. That's just the nature of the region that we live in.
And that generic approach is used in some areas where a signage or recognition or vocal recognition may just say, we recognise the traditional owners of the country on which we broadcast, speak.
It would be good if we could be more specific, but we don't want to put anything up that's incendiary.
So do we have a timeline on when this might be done? Because I did note that the Councillor Widders did say that should any future land claims be successful, then he was happy for a sign to be changed.
Yep. And I think that was a good backstop that he had in there. Native title determinations aren't very common in New South Wales.
That's true.
And they take a long time. So we need to get something up sooner rather than later.
So just staying in that topic, we've just had Sorry Day and a number of issues of late in nationally. Should council have recognised these?
we lowered a flag. What, I mean, what more can we do?
What we, well, I don't know.
Well, you know, where does it start? Where does it finish? I honestly think council's been quite appropriate with all of this. I think people are trying to see things and attach labels to make names for themselves, which is unfortunate. I'm being somewhat cryptic there, but
yes, you are, and that's why I was reading the being something something underneath. All right, I don't have any understanding of this. I was going through council, the minutes of the last council meeting, and one that caught my eye, and I don't know, I don't have any background, so you're going to explain it to me along with everybody else. The airport security screening establishment of a third terminal departure gate for operational use. What is this, and is this a council expense, or is it a state government expense?
It's actually a federal example of cost shifting. The security screening at our... We are a Tier 2 airport, which allows the Qantas to fly in those... the 400 series Dash 8s, which are the ones that have more than 40 passengers. Those planes can only land where there is security screening. So 2 or 3 years ago, the federal government... provided funding for that security screening, which is about $1.1 million per annum ongoing. That funding ceased in January this year. They gave us an extension till the 30th of June. So council is now hit with $1.1 million for security screening. Those planes that don't have, that are 40 seats or less than 40 seats, so both Link and Rex, are not required to be screened. So what will end up happening is, and they will refuse to pay for screening
because they do not.
They don't need it.
Not regulatory requirements for those
at the moment. So what's going to end up happening is that the cost of the screening will end up ultimately being borne by the passengers because the airlines
more
have
cost
to pay
shifting.
It. Yeah, yeah. Now, we're, the other thing is we're a regional airport. About 50% of passengers actually come from the Armidale LGA and the other, you know, from outside, be it Sydney or our neighbouring LGAs. So it's not fair that, in a fairness sense, that the ratepayer foot the bill for it. So one of the attractions of Armidale is that we have three airlines and... If you lose one, particularly on that Sydney route, which has happened in the past, the prices will skyrocket.
And we're not cheap at the moment.
And we're not cheap. It is expensive, but relativity. This is one of these things where relativities are important, and our prices are reasonable compared to other routes without competition.
So coming back to that, there's going to be a third gate built. And there is the requirement for screening. Are council having to wear that, or are you comfortable or confident or relatively confident that that will be covered federally?
So, no, nothing will be covered federally. They've washed their hands of that.
All right. So that's gone?
So that's gone. There's a review as to what screening might be required, and there's a likelihood that in a couple of years everyone will be required to be screened. So that cost could be borne by, could be shared by everyone.
All right. I'm asking because I remember going back some years when the issues of terrorism and bombs on aircraft and everything first raised its head. There was big screening at all the international airports, Sydney, Melbourne, etc., and none in places like Armidale. You could jump on a plane with a bomb in your pocket in Armidale, go straight through to the departure lounge, the international departure lounge in Sydney and fly, and there was this big gaping hole, and we're still, in a sense, this is still trying to plug that.
No, that's been plugged. You can still be unscreened, land in Sydney Airport, but if you're flown down via Rex, you won't be let into the secure area. So you're just released into the general population.
All right. Okay. Now, I think I have a couple of other issues, but time's moving on. We may save those for next time. My name's Paul Tolley. Look, I thank Peter Crick for talking with Mayor Sam Copeland for a very long time. Peter is obviously not able to do that anymore, and I've stepped into the breach, and I hope that this will be an ongoing when we have matters to discuss interview session. But thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. greatly. It's getting close to 11 o'clock. You're listening rather to 2ARM FM.